Support for Science Friday comes from TiVo, delivering cable TV and internet TV together in one searchable and unified viewing experience. Available at TiVo.com.
This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're going to be talking about chicken and chili peppers. Not your, it certainly could be your go-to dish at your favorite Chinese restaurant. But we're going to be talking about domestication, how those first genetic engineers 10,000 years ago, of course not using modern genetic engineering tools, how they started making small changes in plants and animals, and scientists are still piecing together the story of how farming and cultivating food got started. And they're examining everything from genetics to archaeological digs to linguistics to fill in those missing pieces. Greg Larson is an evolutionary biologist at Durham University in Durham, United Kingdom. Welcome to Science Friday. Are you there, Dr. Larson?
I am.
Hi, well, welcome to the program. Paul Goetz is a professor of plant science at the University of California at Davis, UC Davis. He joins us from the campus studio there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good morning, Ira. Good morning, Gregor.
Good morning, Paul.
Nice to have you both. Gregor, let me ask you first. Well, what question were you trying to answer in your chicken study? You studied these chickens and where they came from?
Yeah, so we first started off from a premise of a paper published about 4 years ago that noticed by looking at a large study of modern chickens and wild jungle fowl from which domestic chickens are derived, that said that they found a particular gene that was basically fixed in all of modern domestic chickens, regardless of where they were sampled. And that included samples from Iceland and from Egypt and from Taiwan and globally. And there was a particular variant of this gene that was fixed throughout all domestic chickens and was very different from the variant of that same gene that was found in all of wild jungle fowl. And on that premise, they said that therefore this gene must have been something that was involved with the early change associated with the domestication of chickens. And therefore they said that this was one of the very first possible domestication genes found in animals. In plants, it's relatively simple to do this, but in animals, it hasn't been that simple.
So you're saying...
And doing so...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So what we thought was... Well, if this is the argument they made was based upon a modern ubiquity. They said that if everything domestic has it now and nothing wild has it now, then therefore there must have been present at the very early early stages of domestication. So what we did is we took about 80 samples of ancient chickens just from Europe, just from the last 2,000 years, and if that hypothesis had been true, then everything over the last 2,000 years in Europe should also have been fixed for this particular domestic variant. And what we found was they weren't. Most of them actually had the wild variant, and it was kicking around in the population, but at very low frequencies. And so what this really demonstrated to us was that using modern populations are so radically different from things that even existed 300 or 400 years ago, that if you just use modern populations, you can infer very little about the very early processes of animal domestication.
So the chicken we eat today is a descendant of a jungle fowl?
That's right, yeah.
Red jungle fowl, about 4,000 or 5,000 years ago?
Something like that, yeah. That's really interesting because a lot of other animals we at least have a reasonably good handle on, but with chickens, it's still kind of all over the map. We're really not sure.
Mm-hmm. Did they eat the chickens or did they raise the chickens for just the eggs?
Initially, eating chickens for food only makes sense when you can ramp up chicken production to a very high level. Mm-hmm. Very early chickens were likely involved in things other than just eating them. So there was a lot of ritual practice. There was probably a lot of eggs. They feature very frequently in religious practices and burials and feathers and all these other kinds of things. So, and even chicken fighting for that matter. So very early chickens were likely not selected for the being on the plate.
Our number 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK, if you'd rather do it that way. Paul, you trace the origins of another part of a good chicken and chili dish, and that is the chili peppers. Is it the jalapeno, the habanero? Which one did you trace?
Yeah, so there are about five species of peppers, and the one we looked at is the kind of economically the most important one, the most widespread around the world, and it's a chili pepper which contains jalapenos, for example, but also bell peppers, for example. But in addition to that, there are four other species, and they have slightly different distributions in the Americas. The chili pepper is primarily based in Mexico. Mm-hmm. You have other species in the Caribbean, the Central America, down into the Andes Mountains, the Amazon, and down to Bolivia, actually. So it's good to remember that there are many different chili pepper, peppers in general, yeah. But the one that we focused on is really chili pepper.
Did that chili, the origin of it, did it look like a present-day chili? Did it taste like, have the hot, spicy flavor?
Yes. So yeah. It was spicy, but it looked very different. It's actually a small, round sphere, about a quarter of an inch, not more. So one
really?
Of the effects of, yes, so one of the effects of domestication has been to increase the size, also the shape of the fruit, actually.
Why would you change the fruit? Round is perfect sphere, you know?
Well, but the size is very small. So if you like it, you would want to have a bigger fruit. This has happened all over the place, actually. I think if you look even at other crops like maize, like beans, you see an increase in size when people like it, actually.
And so how big was the original? You say it's very small.
Yeah, a quarter of an inch.
Quarter of an inch.
Yes.
It's less than like a cherry tomato, something like that.
Absolutely, yes. It's very small, but it's also actually still eaten today and sold in the market in Mexico, even I would say in Arizona, for example.
Hmm. Okay. Hey, tell us how you looked at language to help narrow down the origin.
Yeah, so this was a multidisciplinary group, and we had two scientists, Cecil Brown and Jo Coppens of France, and Cecil is at Northern Illinois University, and they take the current languages and then work their way back to find words for pepper. Mm. And in doing so, they found that a group called the Otomangians were the first one to have a special word for pepper. And they also able to date it approximately to about 6,500 years ago.
Hmm. Like we've got calls, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Rick. Hi, Rick. Welcome. Let me see if I can get him on the line here. Hi, Rick. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi there.
I've got a question about pre-Columbian chickens in South America. And I've heard recently that there was a dark-skinned variety of chicken that came from Asia eastward across the Pacific and got to South America before known European contact. I just wondered if I could get any more information on that.
All right, thanks. But before Columbus, were chickens here before Columbus? Do you know about that?
That's a really good question, and I think still an open question. I think some of the early data that came out a few years ago was maybe not quite as open and shut as it may have been initially portrayed in the press. What we know for certain is that chickens were very important to the Polynesians, and they made it certainly as far as Easter Island, without question. And the chickens that were in Hawaii and that were in Easter Island had the same genetic signatures as a lot of the other chickens throughout the Pacific. Whether or not they made it to South America prior to European contact or not is... It still needs some more investigation. There's some suggestions that it was, but nobody's 100% certain one way or the other yet.
You found two genetic differences between the ancestral chicken and the barnyard one that we see today. Can you tell us what those differences were?
So the two that we looked at, one was just this trait of having yellow skin, which is really pretty interesting because the wild jungle fowl from which chickens are derived have gray skin. And the yellow skin is really restricted to a completely different species called the gray jungle fowl, which is only found in South Asia. And we suspect that what's happened was the chickens were domesticated in Southeast Asia and then moved with people to South Asia, whereupon they interbred with South Asian chickens and then acquired this trait but still retained most of the genome from the red jungle fowl but then had yellow skin. Although what we found was that even 500, 600 years ago, the yellow skin trait was there genetically but was probably not being expressed. And so if you went back 500 or 600 years ago in Europe, most of the chickens you would see, the vast majority in fact, would have gray skin. And it's only very recently that this trait has popped up and then just been really expressed nearly to fixation. And the other one was something called TSHR, which is a thyroid-stimulating hormone receptor, involved in something to do with behavior. Might have something to do with how frequently the chickens can lay eggs, may have something to do with whether or not they can exist in very close confines with one another. Difficult to say. We're not quite sure what it does, but we know that in modern domestic chickens, this thing is everywhere, but in wild chickens, they don't have the particular trait that the domestic ones do. So it's clearly important, but the value of that importance has really only become evident in populations over the last couple of hundred years.
I'm also fascinated by the cultural implications you were talking about, that you found graves with of people with chicken bones in them. Chickens were buried with people.
Sure. I mean, people have been buried with all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Dogs are a very famous example, but there was an example just 10,000 years ago of a woman being buried with a cat.
But why a chicken? I feel like I'm like Groucho Marx. Why a chicken? You know.
Yeah, I think that one really interesting thing that some recent research has discovered is that the way that we currently view animals, and chickens in particular, is kind of, they're everywhere and they're fungible. A chicken is a chicken and they're just kind of there. You can't really distinguish one individual from another. But the way that our ancestors viewed their animals was much more individualized and much more to do with personality and ownership with single people in the way that we kind of conceive of our pet dogs now.
Yeah.
You know, there are wild dogs that are running around in parts of the world, but people just think of them as pests or pigeons or cockroaches or rats, and these are the kinds of things. But for most of history, I think that the archaeological evidence certainly is suggesting that people's relationship with chickens was much more personal, and they invested a lot more in individual chickens than we would even think about doing today.
Mm-hmm.
If I could add something,
yes.
To the story of the chicken in South America, at least there is evidence from plants, crops actually, for contact in the other direction between South America and into the islands of the Pacific, and that is the story of sweet potato, which was transported somehow from South America. That's where it originated, was domesticated into the islands of the Pacific, and this has been recently determined using actually DNA from herbaria that were collected by the Cook expedition. So they were the first Europeans to come there, and at that time already there was sweet potato. So clearly there is there was contact, in which directions, that I think remains to be determined, if it was in both directions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Paul makes an important point there, which is that it's through studies that incorporate not just people sitting in their own individual offices working on their own individual organisms with their particular data set, but it's through the kind of multidisciplinary studies that Paul was talking about initially that include things like dating and morphology and isotopes and DNA and archaeological context and even mm-hmm. ethnography and linguistics mm-hmm. that will pull together a whole range of domestic animals and plants and people to really start to investigate these
yeah.
questions in total.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Frank in Dallas. Hi, welcome to Science Friday, Frank.
Hi, good afternoon. Very interesting program. I'm enjoying it, like always.
Thank you.
One of the things, one of the questions, and it's been, I'm originally from Mexico City, and one of the things that I've seen is a great variety of peppers, from the little piquin, which is a tiny pepper that's extremely hot, to the poblano pepper, which is large and absolutely delightful. So how did this variety of peppers come about, and why is Mexico the center of the majority of those peppers?
Great question. Thank you. Great question. Yeah, how do they don't have the modern techniques. How do they get all those varieties, and why?
Well, I think that you have to associate biological diversity and cultural diversity, and people have different tastes, and they will respond to novelty. And you see that in all crops. It's not just peppers. It's corn. It's beans. Wheat and
well, how do you select for it? If you find a novelty, you say, is it a mutation, and then you start growing it separately? How do you select for
yeah.
what you want?
So it's usually, I think it's a visual selection. That's what they had available.
Mm.
And probably because their life depended on food, they were very keen observers of the variation in their fields. And so you can select, meaning you would keep the seeds separate or a cutting separate and replant it, and then maintain that difference in the field year after year. And that's how you, with time, you start
yeah.
increasing the diversity.
Yeah.
And the criteria of having a lot of diversity was already recognized a century ago, to say that a center of diversity in many cases, but not always, but in many cases also the center of origin or the center of domestication of a crop or an animal.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. talking with Greg Larson and Paul Goetz. Couple of minutes left to go here. What else would you like to know? Are you working on any other peppers, chickens, foods, any other fowl or veggies of any kind? Greg, Paul.
I'm working on beans, common bean like pinto beans, black beans, and so on. And that
I'm getting hungry. Just listen.
Yeah, and it has some, you know, and beans with pepper. It's but it is also somewhat the same story that you have this wide range of distribution in the Americas, and beans also range from Mexico all the way to Argentina. Mm-hmm. And I've done collections of wild beans in these areas. And right now we have been funded to conduct relate the environment of these wild beans and look particularly at areas where they grow that are fairly dry in the hope of finding understanding the process of domestication, but also mm-hmm. identifying maybe genes or wild beans that are more tolerant to drought, for example.
Gregor? Okay.
We've got a major research project right now on dogs, pigs, and chickens, where we're really trying to investigate, as Paul said, the earliest phases of answering the major questions: where, why, when, and how were these animals domesticated? I think that there's been a huge amount of work done just in the last couple of years that has gotten into the theory and to the ideas about how people were interacting with the landscapes and thinking about it more in an evolutionary biology context rather than as a top-down, people go out and they domesticate things. This is sort of the way that it's popularly conceived. Right. And we're using those tools and a lot of genetics and a lot of isotopes and a lot of morphology to really try and get to the heart of this, to identify the populations in time and space that were the first ones that were domesticated and all the subsequent populations that have subsequently provided DNA to the crazy, admixed, bizarre populations that we have now that our ancestors would certainly never even recognize as domestic animals.
I have to ask you one quick question from a tweet that came in from Bruce Clemens. He says, we're defining irony in that Gregor works in genetics, meaning Gregor Mendel in genetics with lima beans experiments. You must get kidded about that a little bit.
I do, but I always kind of back out of that a little bit by saying he was Gregor with an O-R and I'm Gregor with an E-R. So I'm not, you know, I'm related, but maybe not quite perfectly descended.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Gregor Larson, with an E, is an evolutionary biologist at Durham University in Durham, United Kingdom. Paul Goetz is a professor of plant science at the University of California, UC Davis. He joined us from a campus studio there.